Welcome to the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection, where Colorado trial lawyers share insights from their latest cases. Join me, Keith Fuselli, as we uncover the stories, strategies, and lessons from recent Colorado trials to help you and your clients achieve justice in the courtroom. The pursuit of justice starts now. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection podcast. Amazing episode up ahead, where we are thrilled to have Sandra Hagen and Paula Slaughter on to talk about just an amazing $3 million plus verdict in El Paso County on a fascinating medical causation case. So we are thrilled to have first-time attendees Paula and Sandra on the show. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Keith. Thanks for having us, Keith. Excited to be here.
I'm so excited. And the one thing that I learned before you all jumped on is both of you have tried between you each between like 35 and 40 civil trials. I just want to say that is amazing and kudos to you. How is it that in you both are obviously very young, how in your short years of practice were you able to try so many cases? That is phenomenal.
I had my own law firm for over a decade, and so I was front row to all of those trials. So that part made it really exciting to try cases from intake all the way to verdict. I was really young when I started my law firm. I think I was like 29 or 30 and had nothing to lose and, you know, everything to gain. And so that's how I started. And now I'm at Will Height Law Firm with Sandy, and we are high volume. So we get a lot of opportunity to try really interesting cases with interesting fact patterns around the state. It's cool to get in there and do it.
Yeah. And the cool thing about Will Height is, yeah, you're high volume, but you're also trying a lot of cases. So sometimes I feel like, oh, high volume means no trials. And I think oftentimes the opposite is true. Sandra, has that been your experience at Will Height, that you're just trying cases left and right? Seems like it.
It is. I initially started as Rob Wilhite's paralegal way back in the day. He's always been very supportive of, if the insurance company isn't going to play, let's just go try the thing, you know, as long as our clients are on board with it. And the way our firm is structured, we have a litigation team. Our litigation team is very trial focused. You start, when you pick up that case from pre-litigation, you're planning for trial from day one. So it's a very encouraged thing that we do in our lit department.
Yeah. And I just think when you try a lot of cases and your results speak for themselves, which they do, then it just trickles down. And then you're getting better offers in pre-lit and everything just moves better. So what a great world that you have grown up in, if you will, as attorneys, to get to try so many cases. And let me start with you, Sandra. Did you always know that you wanted to be a trial lawyer? I mean, I'm guessing that that was sort of, you're working in the trenches, then all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, I'm going to become a lawyer. How'd that come about?
Actually, law was my second career. My first part of my adult life, I was in restaurant management. Then I had my daughter and decided to go back to school. I initially went back to become a teacher. And then somewhere along the way, I was like, maybe I want to be a lawyer. And so I figured, you know, we're already broke, so let's just go for it. And so I did. And when I started law school, I actually went in thinking, I just want to like be in-house somewhere and write contracts. That was my goal. And I ended up interning with a criminal defense attorney. My very first foray into the courtroom was arguing a case in front of the North Dakota Supreme Court as a 3L.
Wow. So what was that experience like?
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. I think there's an audio of it out there somewhere, and I'm just afraid to listen. I don't want to know. I didn't win.
But you still argued in front of the North Dakota Supreme Court. I mean, there is something to be said for that. So congratulations there. And then how did you end up doing plaintiff side trial work?
Well, when I moved here, I wasn't licensed. And so I was looking for paralegal work. And I had applied a bunch of different places. And this is back in the time of Craigslist. And so I had an ad out, and Rob Wilhite was in his, I think, second year of practice. So he reached out, interviewed, and the rest is history.
So you started as Rob's paralegal?
Yes. Yeah. And then about 2 or 3 years later, he said, you got to go take the bar. He's like, you're just wasting your time here. So he encouraged me to take the bar. I did. And here we are.
Wow. That is so fantastic. I think that you mentioned that you had a daughter, I guess, not too long ago, part of this process. And your daughter now, I think you told me off air, is 30 years old. You must be very proud knowing that she must be so proud of you to have done all that you have done with a young child. I mean, just tell our listeners a little bit about what inside of you kept you going.
Once I got fixated on the idea, it was more about taking it, you know, one day at a time, sometimes 1 minute at a time, because if you back up and you look, it's too much and it's too overwhelming. So you just say, okay, what do I have to do to get through the next hour, the next day? You know, 10,000 hours later, I got a few trials under my belt. So,
wow, that is fantastic. And kudos to you. Kudos. Paula, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you come to be a rock star plaintiff's trial lawyer?
I just wanted to go snowboarding. I got out of college and was a real estate broker for a little bit. Didn't really want to stay in that lane and came out to Denver to visit a friend, got some snowboarding in, visited DU Law. And I was like, I think I could do this. So applied to a few law schools. DU gave me a lot of money to go there. I got out and still didn't know I wanted to be a trial attorney. Did some tax work. And then in my late 20s, started a law firm and got into the courtroom and loved it. I remember waiting for one of my first verdicts and it felt like being on a roller coaster. And you know it inches up. And I'm a first row roller coaster person. And you know you're inching up and then your feet start to dangle cause you're about to drop. That is the feeling right there of being at that table is the few seconds right before you go. When you get that phone call and the clerk says the verdict is in, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just telling you the story right now that you go and you're sitting there and you're waiting and it's just this buildup and this buildup and you are, you know, watching the judge like get the envelope and read the verdict. And it's, there's nothing like it. There's absolutely nothing like that feeling, win or lose, honestly.
That is a very good analogy. Now I see why you have done so well in trial, because your analogy skills are second to none.
They are on point, for sure.
I'll tell you what, I am a little bit nauseous hearing you describe it, because what I have experienced, I don't know if you all disagree. For me, sort of one of the best feelings is when you're just waiting on the verdict, because you're like, you know what? I'm done. I can finally relax. Candidly, I like to go find a place and have a beer, because I don't drink like a week before. I don't drink during trial. So I need like a beer when I'm waiting for that verdict. I got to ask you, you are wearing a sweatshirt that says Clever Bully. That is an awesome sweatshirt. Tell me a little bit about Clever Bully. What's that?
Oh, thanks. So Clever Bully is a brand that I came up with my husband. I had gone through a few years where it was a rough. I had come out of a really big divorce and it was a lot. And so I was feeling a little beat down by the system. You know, family law can be really hard. Shout out to the family lawyers out there, because I could never do that. I learned that you have to be clever and sometimes outsmart the problem and come out on the other side on top of the things that were like really burying you. And so we kind of came up with this, like, you know, you can be a clever bully. You don't have to be a bully. You can be somebody that's clever. And then I thought about that and it kind of bled into how we deal with insurance companies, is you have to be clever.
Yeah, I almost feel like I want a Clever Bully t-shirt to wear underneath a suit when I'm in trial, sort of like that armor to go into battle.
I will get you one, because it feels good to wear this.
Offer accepted, offer accepted. So let's talk about this amazing result, $3+ million in Colorado Springs, just absolutely amazing. And before we do that, I know in speaking off air that you both said that you try a lot of cases together. So tell us a little bit about that. And specifically for this case, how do you as a trial team go about dividing up responsibilities?
With any case, when you're assigned a case at our firm, you're the lead counsel, it's your case. And we work pretty independently, except for, you know, in rare occasions, we'll double up early on. But for the most part, you get the case, it's your baby. And if it goes to trial, then you start wandering around the hallways looking for who wants to co-counsel with me on this trial. This was actually Paula's case. She took lead. And so she asked me about a month out, I think. Yeah. You know, she said, this one's going to go. And I'd had a case recently settled, so I did.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. So you start to sort of figure out who's going to do the case with you about a month or so out. Is that true for you, Paula, and Sandra, about a month out? You kind of look to, you have a feeling at that point, mediation's done, you know the case is going. That's when you go get a second chair, if you will.
Yeah. And the other thing that's neat about our firm is we have enough litigators who are pretty seasoned. So if there's a particular area of damages, say TBI or something like that, some of our attorneys are really great at certain things. And so you look at it and say, oh, okay, this is a case maybe where I want Zach Elsner on because he's great with the neuropsych stuff. Or, you know, in this case, and what I do when I'm lead is we usually divide up the case by issue. So if there's engineering, if there's medical, if there's lay witnesses, depending on how many counsel we have, we kind of put everybody in the same box. That's what Paula did in this case as well.
Yep. And we had tried a TBI case together like 4 years ago.
It was before COVID.
Yeah.
It was right after COVID.
Yeah. We tried it 4 years ago together and we got a wonderful result. I think you got a $990,000 verdict like or something like that. And we just work really well together. You know, I think when you have a trial partner that you've worked with before, you have a lot of faith in each other, you know, that they're going to get their part done. And they have faith in you that you've done that work to get it to verdict, right? And that they can sort of drop in where they're asked to be dropped in.
Yeah.
And we just naturally work really well together.
Yeah. Who did what in the trial? So how did you divide up voir dire, opening, and those various parts of the trial?
So for this trial, optics were really important to me. I really wanted us to look like a very well-prepared, female-driven team. I also really wanted to make sure that we were kind of in and out surgically with the jury. So we had two experts. We had our plaintiff and we had one lay witness, our plaintiff's brother. And so the way that I divided it, and they had two experts. We had a neurologist, they had a neurologist. We had like a musculoskeletal MD. They had the same thing, an orthopedics guy. And so basically we divided it between neuro. Sandy did the neuro and then I did the musculoskeletal witnesses. That played out really great in terms of preparation because Sandy could really focus on just the neuro. She did the lay witness, our plaintiff's brother. And then I took everything else. I was really excited about this case. I really was. The defense team wasn't paying attention. They weren't taking it seriously. And so I knew Sandy had been really busy. And so I said, look, let me do voir dire, opening, closing. I've really doubled down on voir dire lately. It's something for the past 2 years that I've focused on pretty heavily is voir dire. And so I just wanted to keep going with that.
So Paula, you were sort of, I guess this was your case, your baby from the get-go. How did you divide up? How did you and Sandra decide who's doing what during trial?
So this case for me, I really wanted us to look really prepared, really ready, and to really tighten up our story and be surgical about how we presented it to the jury. Sandy and I had done a TBI trial together before a couple of years ago. And so I really wanted her to take the neuro on this one. She's just really gifted at getting really beautiful pieces of testimony out from direct examination of our doctors and then her cross-examination. I mean, to watch Sandy cross any expert, but to cross the neuro is like a masterclass. And I had seen her do it in Arapahoe County when we did a TBI case together 4 years ago. And when I asked her to do this trial, I said, you have to cross their neuro. Like, you have got to be that guy that's going to go in and bruise them up. And she did exactly that. And I knew she had been really busy. So, you know, one of the things that we try to do that I've kind of said before is you want your second chair to really drop in really easily and without too much pressure. And so I told her, look, I'll do the rest of the trial. If you can do the neuro portion, do our neuro, cross their neuro, and then take a lay witness. I'll do everything else.
Okay, so did you do voir dire and opening?
I did. I've really been focusing on voir dire. I've kind of doubled down on voir dire in the past 2 years. I've gotten into, Sari Delamotte. I don't know if you're familiar with her, Hostage to Hero, 12 Heroes, One Voice. And that's kind of where I've been putting the focus of my trial work. Everybody does things differently, but honestly, for me, doubling down on voir dire is what's worked for me. I've noticed that my verdicts have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger as I've started to really double down on voir dire and employ what I've been, you know, learning through these books and podcasts. I went from smaller verdicts to like 750,000, 600,000, and now, you know, 3.2 million from really focusing on it.
It's marvelous. And I will give a plug to Sari de Lamont. I went out and spent 3 days doing her trial lab on a big case that I had where 3 days on the opening, it was very, very useful. I'm sort of with you. I feel like for me, voir dire is always an evolving process, but you know, one of our core values is better tomorrow than today. And I do feel like as long as we're better tomorrow than we are today, then life's moving in the right direction. Sounds like you're emboldening that, embodying that. Amazing. Love it.
I have to interject something because she and I, while we're both pretty chill, and that's why we work pretty well together, she didn't want to look at any of the juror questionnaires. And I just couldn't even wrap my head around doing a voir dire without having looked at that. And she's like, nope, I don't want to look at it. She doesn't. She goes in cold and builds her tribe. And I love it.
Oh, that's amazing. So Paula, tell us a little bit about the facts of this case. And then I want to get into the cross of the neuro and some of the sort of fascinating medical issues that arose in this case.
Absolutely. So our plaintiff is Anthony Carter. This crash happened on December 7th of 2021. He was about 74 at the time. He had been a tile master for his life, had done a lot of like hands-on work. And he was fishing down at the reservoir with a friend of his. He's coming back up on I-25 northbound. And there's all that construction right around Colorado Springs. And so he comes to a dead stop. He's driving like a 1990-1991 Mercedes, the kind that used to be made out of metal. You know, the bumper was fully metal. Everything in the car is metal. And then defendant Matthew Monday is driving this Ford Transit van, and he's driving it for this weed farm called Montefiore. And he's going about 65 miles an hour. He'll never admit it. He said he looked down for a second, but I have my suspicions about what he was looking down at. He hit Mr. Carter at 65 miles an hour.
Wow. And you said weed farm, like marijuana farm or?
Yeah. So the van was just full of weed products that he was delivering to these like various dispensaries. The property damage was significant. I mean, the collision, the forces of the collision were enough that the metal bolts of the driver's seat in Mr. Carter's car broke and came undone. His headrest broke. He was dazed at the scene, but obviously concerned about anybody else that was involved in the wreck. And so he was transported by ambulance. So was Mr. Monday. And basically what that led to is at 74 years old, he started having some AFib, atrial fibrillation. And then after about 7 months, he suffered like a triple cardioembolic stroke, which I'm going to let Sandy talk to you about because she's, you know, got it dialed in on the neuro. But the crux of the case was, did this crash cause these strokes or not? And he had some significant musculoskeletal injuries as well. You know, he had a T2, T3 compression fracture. But I really think that the case was, is this person significantly and permanently injured?
So client gets AFib that then eventually leads to the stroke. So help me understand your neurologist, I understand it was Dr. Gray. What did she tell the jury how one thing led to another?
Honestly, I had never heard of this before either. So I got a big education in a very quick period of time on this. So how she explained it was, obviously, this crash is hard enough and the forces are hard enough for whether he hits his head on the headrest or it's a whiplash. I don't think it really mattered, because there was certainly enough force there to give him a TBI. When he's taken to the ambulance, and an interesting fact is that he doesn't really talk to anybody super early on, because there's three cars involved in this. And one of the cars, that guy had a warrant out for his arrest, and so there was like a whole thing. By the time he's actually talking to someone, there's plenty of time that has passed, probably close to a half an hour, I think. Whatever he's feeling, you know, a little dazed and confused right after it happens, but doesn't report it to anybody. And so he goes to the hospital, and because of his age, they did a head CT, but didn't diagnose him with a concussion, didn't diagnose him with a TBI. But interestingly, they didn't find the compression fracture either. So there was a lot of, not necessarily missteps, but a lot of things missed at the ER.
And I'm assuming the head CT scan was normal?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, it was. All right. Which is important, because we're not seeing any of the indications for the ischemic strokes that he has then down the road. So he has a TBI. He gets his treatment, and he's reporting, you know, headaches and some irritability and, you know, the usual cognitive type stuff. But, you know, he lives with his brother. They're both in their late 70s and nobody's really thinking about this. They're treating the physical side of it. And like Paula said, about 7 months later, he has this stroke. So Dr. Gray explained it to the jury that he has this TBI, which starts sort of this cascade. He's put into, for lack of a better term, fight or flight. So he's operating at this sort of high level called sympathetic overdrive. So your parasympathetic system is just idling really high. And then that is creating this, you know, these heart palpitations and leading to the AFib. Then the AFib starts running its course through the heart. Those little clots are making their way to his brain. So he ends up having, I want to say it was 5 areas of ischemic stroke 7 months later.
Okay, so it's making a little more sense to me, because I'll sort of confess my ignorance when you're talking about an ischemic stroke, that these are micro strokes, if you will. So this isn't one big blood clot going to the brain. These are small little blood clots over time. Is that right?
Yeah, they don't happen. And the way Dr. Gray explained it, these don't happen overnight. That was another piece of the causation was, well, if this was going to happen, it should have happened more immediate. Well, it didn't, because it's a whole cascade of symptoms that lead to this ultimate result. And so the defense doctor blamed it on Imbruvica because he had
cancer.
He had leukemia. Mm-hmm. And so he was on Imbruvica, but we were able to show the studies he'd been on this for years. And so with Imbruvica, yes, it can cause AFib, but it typically causes the AFib within 4 months of starting the medication. So you usually know pretty early on if the Imbruvica is going to be an issue.
All right. I want to do a little more of a deep dive into this medical issue for the education of our listeners and strategically. Now, first of all, tell us a little bit about the defense neurologist, Bruce Morgenstern.
I think you can look at it two ways. You can either look at it as a curse or a gift, because he's going to stick to his guns. He has testified far more times than I've ever been in trial. And he's got his script and he's very polished when he's talking to the jury. He also, what I found, was kind of aware of the traps that he could be walked into. So he wasn't fighting me on things, because I think he realized I had the goods. So he knew to just sort of cop to things, if that makes sense. So it was kind of more like, I have to show the jury basically that your opinions are sort of absurd and that they are historically absurd. We had audio taped his Rule 35 exam. And so there were inconsistencies between the tape and what was in his report. So we highlighted those. We had the tape ready to roll if he were going to try and work around it, but he knew. He did this comprehensive cognitive test and the 3 words, and you wait 5 minutes. And I'm like, you didn't wait 5 minutes, did you? He's like, no, it was probably a little less. Half. It was 2.5 minutes. And 2 of the words he had actually repeated in another test. So you're dropping the hints along the way. So he was interesting. He was tough. He was, you know, he wouldn't keep himself contained to a yes or no and things like that. But I think after a period of time, I think the jury just kind of realized this is insane. He had found no concussion in some pretty clear cases, a warehouse dock door falling on someone's head and a pretty significant electric shock. My own colleague, Anastasia Evans, had a client and she had a big hematoma on her head, and he'd done that report saying no concussion. So I think it was just showing the jury absurdity.
Jury didn't like him.
Yeah, I was going to ask sort of how you went about finding these prior examples of absurdities. Were those just in office cases, or did you reach out to the listserv or other ways to get those examples?
So I did pull a fair amount of stuff off of the listserv, but Paula had also been working with Expert Institute and they had done a trial. And so she said, hey, look up what you can find on Dr. Morgenstern through here. And it was crazy the amount of information that was available, not just prior reports, prior depositions, but things that, you know, his messages on different message boards throughout the medical community. There was a listing of all of the pharmaceutical payouts he had taken, letters that he'd written back in Ohio regarding malpractice claims, including there was one that had just this absolute piece of gold saying, the problem with these malpractice cases is the bias of defense doctors. I mean, you can't make it up, right? It's little drops of gold. So
Paula, tell us a little bit about the service with the Expert Institute that you used. And we've heard some of the amazing information. Was it easy to use? Is that something you do a lot of cases going forward?
So I had never done it before. I said, all right, let's give it a shot. It's called Expert Radar, and it's like ops. They get all the ops on the other guy. And it was incredibly easy to use. I mean, they did a really quick turnaround for me. It was like 24, 48 hours. They kind of walk you through it. It looks sort of like a FileVine system maybe, and you can click through all the different tabs. So you can go into a tab that gives you the general overview of how many times he's testified for the defense versus plaintiff's work. It'll give you where he's testified in the country. And then you can go on a tab and it'll have all of his like employment. They have a, like a miscellaneous tab where I think it's where Sandy found that he had written this letter to this newspaper while he was being sued for malpractice about the bias of these defense experts. And so what an awesome tool. I am going to use it. I'm going to trial again in June and I plan to use it on all three experts. I have Allison Fall, Dr. Chen, and Peter Himsel. And so
I'm going to
use it there. Yeah, the big three.
Yeah, I was going to say the trifecta. God.
So Sandra, how did you, this nugget, this golden nugget you have, did you lead your cross with this, you know, the concern about the bias of defense doctors, or where did you place that in your cross?
Honestly, Keith, I have to be honest. I didn't use it.
Wow.
I didn't use it. I had planned to. And sort of the way, the trajectory of how the cross went, I ended up pulling back on some of it. I thought that we had already gotten there. And I don't think it would have mattered at that point.
I want to dive a little bit into that because I'm hearing you say that, and I know from talking a little bit offline, is it you got to a spot where you felt like the jurors were on your side? You had accomplished what you wanted to, and you didn't want to like beat them up anymore and like go too far. Is that kind of how that went down in your mind?
Yeah, I think at one point the cross-examination got a little bit heated to the point where the judge had to intervene. He called a break. And at that point, I just felt like, okay, let's recalibrate. Actually, I can't remember if I brought out the parade of horribles before or after the break. But once I had done that, I think out of the corner of my eye, I could kind of see the jurors like kind of doing that, like, yeah, we're done here. And I try in as much as I can take my cues from where the jury is done with it. So we wrapped it up pretty quickly after that.
With the parade of horribles, is that the prior cases where there was an obvious concussion and he was saying no concussion?
Yeah, multiple of those, but yeah.
Walk the listeners through sort of how that played out practically. Do you remember this case? And would he admit, yes, I do remember that case. Would he fight you on the individual facts of those cases? Or give us a little bit more about how that particular strategy of showing absurdities in other cases, absurd opinions, how you practically put that into practice.
So, and this is where I'm saying he's seasoned enough to know what I was doing. I would say, you know, we would switch gears. We were talking about something where he hadn't found a concussion in our case. And I said, well, I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you about a few other cases you've testified in. Do you recall testifying in a trial called, you know, whatever the name of the trial? And he's like, oh, I'm not sure. And I'm like, let me give you a few facts. And then this was a case where this gentleman was delivering candy to a Walgreens and the warehouse dock door fell on his head. Do you recall that? And then he was like, oh, yeah, I think so. You know, he didn't fight me on it because I think he realized I was going to be ready with the testimony.
I guess that's my question is because my mind is spinning about how we're going to do this in the trial we have next week. Did you have the report ready to go to refresh his memory if he waffled at all, or deposition? What did you have?
Absolutely. I had the deposition. I had copies ready for defense counsel and the judge if he were going to. So I, you know, I walked in the binder about this big of his cross. But like I said, this is where you can tell probably more of the seasoned experts. He didn't fight me because I think he knew. And it was easier for him to sort of downplay. He's like, yeah, I think I might. Yeah, well, there was other things going on. And he would be very wishy-washy about it. But again, what I wanted for my purposes was to just, I didn't want to get into the whole situation of it. I wanted the optic of garage door falls on somebody's head and you're not finding a concussion. Okay, next.
And so his excuse was, well, there's other facts that you're not covering. And you're just like, okay, let's move on to the next case. Is that kind of how it went down?
Right. And I think with the electric shock, he's like, that's well, a good one. Well, how many volts or whatever? And I think it was 120 volts. That's just like, what does he say? A hairdryer or an outlet or something? I can't remember what it was. But it was like, that was sort of his back and forth to it.
Do you believe that, because as you're explaining this, I'm thinking, on the one hand, it sounds a little bit of a difficult causation of tying the strokes to this crash. And you have, you know, Dr. Gray explaining physiologically how that occurs. And then on the other hand, you have the defense doctor going almost too far. And so I almost wonder if the fact that that doctor took such an extreme position of no concussion then resulted in your verdict. Do you have an opinion on if that's what happened?
I think it very well could have. Again, with Morgenstern, we spent so much time on the TBI itself versus the stroke because he wasn't finding the TBI in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So that I had to show the jury that his opinion on the TBI seemed to lack credibility. And then they can pick up where Allison Gray was and then run the ball to the end zone on that.
Talk to us a little bit about the difficulties, how difficult it was to establish the existence of a concussion, given the 30-minute delay, the negative CT scan. I'm assuming that the neurologic examination in the emergency room was fine, totally intact, you know, no issues whatsoever. So how did you overcome that piece to establish the concussion occurred here?
A couple of things. First of all, there is nobody, he's not speaking to anybody in the first nearly half hour. And so it kind of came down to, if a tree falls in the forest, and I think those words actually came out of my mouth during my cross. Second of all, we went through very meticulously the ER records. There was a timeline in the nursing notes of when all of these evaluations were to have occurred. The neurologic exam was, well, actually, I think every single systems check, including the neurological exam, was 4 minutes. Something like that.
Every single check, including like elder abuse and like fall risk. I mean, we walked them through in your cross of Morgenstern in Dr. Gray, and then I did it with Haley Burke, that timeline of look at how many tests they're doing, and it's 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their complete assessment.
So the timeline, was that on the actual records, or did you have to get like the medical audit, the medical metadata to find those timelines of what occurred?
No, it was right in their medical records. It was in the nursing notes. So in the ER records, they would put timestamps next to the different things that were happening. So I think when we were preparing, I was like, Paula, look at this. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's one of the things I love about doing this is I'm learning something new myself because I recall some of these ER records, like I have seen those timestamps, but not always. For you to be able to look at that and say, wait a minute, to be able to prove something that we all know, which is that these ER examinations are very quick, very cursory. And so you're able to look at it and say, look at all these things that they did in 4 minutes. And they want to have you believe that, you know, this is some kind of comprehensive neuropsychological or neurological assessment. That is brilliant.
Yeah. And Haley Burke was great at really sort of digging in on what the point of the emergency room is.
Yeah.
It's not to do all of these assessments. It's, are you going to die?
Yeah.
Quick practical question on that. because that, I love that testimony. And, you know, Dr. Burke testifies for the defense often as well and can be devastating on the defense side, as I think we all know. Did you include in your expert disclosures that Dr. Burke was going to talk about what normally occurs in the emergency room and that it's not really designed, you know, it's designed to save your life, but they're not doing sort of a full-blown assessment? And the only reason why I ask that question is that something that our listeners need to be aware of, finding out if a treating doctor is going to testify about that and actually putting in the body of our expert disclosures? Or A, did the defense not object? And B, if they did object, are you sort of like, look, this is just part and parcel of the underlying opinions?
So it wasn't in our expert disclosure and it wasn't in her report. And I was really surprised at how much we got in. Overall, broadly speaking, I don't think, and the defense team was very gifted. You know, it's Brandon Freedy and Jason Malachar. They're both gifted attorneys. I just don't think they took this case seriously. And so there were some parts that they weren't paying attention to. For example, Sandy does this beautiful direct of Allison Gray. And at the end, she moves to admit Dr. Gray's records because Dr. Gray was our hybrid treater slash retained. There was no objection to those records coming in. And so in my closing, I urged the jury to read the first 8 pages because it had a records review in there. There had been some letters that Mr. Carter's like treating cardiologist had written about the AFib and another treating doc in there. And so Dr. Gray had kind of gone through all of that. And when there was no objection to it coming in, you know, and I told the jury, you should read it. Our colleagues on the other side after that said, wait a second, that came in. And we were both like, you didn't object. And then Judge Prince said, yeah, you didn't object. And then you could just sort of see the color on their face was like, uh-oh. Yeah. So there were just some things that trial kind of gives you as a gift of them just not really taking this case as seriously as I think we took it. And in speaking to the jury afterwards, that is what came through. And the jury did tell our friends on the other side that we were very much more prepared and polished, not only ourselves, but also our doctors, and that their team didn't have that same presentation.
You mentioned at the beginning that you really wanted the optics to be prepared on the right side. Tell us a little bit more about your thinking and preparation of the optics piece of this and what our listeners can learn as they're getting ready to march into trial.
Absolutely. So, you know, anytime a case is assigned to me, the first thing I do is I think about what am I going to tell a jury in my closing argument? And then I build backwards from there. How do I want this to look? As I was taking depositions and kind of building this case, I was realizing that what we really needed was just a really prepared, polished team, because these were going to be really complicated neurological things that I don't think your average juror was going to be able to understand. And so we already had Allison Gray on the case because she was already a treater, but I brought Haley Burke in because she absolutely demolished me in Adams County a few years ago. And I was like, I'm never going to have that again. I want her on my team because she can explain things in this really beautiful, polished way to the jury that they really grab onto. I mean, she was 80% of the reason that when she demolished me in Adams County, it was admitted liability and we got a defense verdict because she just wiped us. And so I wanted us to have this team, and Sandy comes with it. She is so prepared. She's so polished. She's so ready. She knows every medical record in and out because that's how she prepares for trial. And I wanted that look. I liked the look of having four women. No offense to the men out there. No offense to you, Keith. But I wanted this look of this team where we were really taking care of this older gentleman who is a cute little old man. And he's got this team of like legal folks and medical folks that are here to be able to tell a story and take care of him. And then on the other side, we had these two defense attorneys who weren't taking it seriously. We had two male doctors who also weren't taking it seriously. In fact, Philip Stahl got on the stand and said that he wasn't sure why he was there because he was only supposed to talk about the shoulder and didn't know he was supposed to talk about the back. I just kind of, you know, rolled into that and cross of him. I was like, you don't even know why you're here. It was this whole other team. The defendants never came. So they also didn't show up for trial. So it's this whole other team of folks not taking our client and his very, very serious injuries and permanent injuries seriously.
Oh my gosh. Did you know that Stoll was going to say that he only thought it was the shoulder before trial? Or, I mean, that was just like a gift that was given to you.
It was a gift.
I think we looked at each other and we're like, what?
His whole report was about the compression fracture. His report only had a little paragraph about this big about the shoulder. So when he said that, I thought, gosh. And then, you know, you have these moments after you've tried a bunch of cases, you realize the jury doesn't know what's in his report. I'm going to capitalize on this.
Right.
Hey, jurors, you don't know that the report that I'm holding in my hand is 8 pages of compression fracture. So this guy gets up there and says, oh, I don't even know why I'm here. He was very like cutesy about it. And, you know, my cross was less than maybe 10 minutes. I mean, I didn't have a lot to say after he got up there and said, I don't know why I'm here.
Does that come with experience when you have accomplished what you need to and then just do sit down?
Yes, absolutely.
Because you don't open the door to redirect.
You don't. And so you learn that as you go along, right? And the only way to learn that is to actually be in trial and have those moments of, I think I need to sit down now. We've done the work here and we've left the impression we want to leave with the jury. And in speaking with them afterwards, it absolutely played out that way. So I'm kind of glad that like my trial instinct was, I want this trial to be about optics. And that's exactly what the jury told me at the end was what did it for them and why they awarded so much money.
And what foresight you had about the optics, not just of having, you know, the female team against to help this older gentleman, but of being super prepared, having everything inside and out. And then the defense walks in and puts up a doctor that's like, I don't know why I'm here. It just makes the defense look incompetent. And you couldn't have predicted that, but it like played out perfectly. Kudos to you.
Thank you. It was a fun trial. I mean, admittedly, Keith, in my closing, I only asked for $900,000. I did not ask.
I was just about to ask for the damage ask and how. So let's talk a little bit about your, because you both have so much experience trying so many cases. Sandra, let's start with you. Talk to us a little bit about your philosophy on impairment, non-economic damages, and what sort of you have found works and what doesn't work. And what can we learn from you?
Well, I actually was going to defer this back to Paula because we did have an interesting quirk with the non-economic damages in this case. But, you know, in cases now, I'm trying to do my best to get actual impairment doctors because I think that's historically for me been the hardest category of damages to quantify to a jury and explain. We've had it, I think the last few trials I've had, the impairment has come through. The juries have really sort of grasped on to what that's about. But I'm going to defer to Paula, actually, on the non-economics because, like I said, they're a little quirk in this case.
Well, and let's talk about that because I know from your write-up, it has to do with responding to written discovery where they're asking you to quantify impairment or non-economic damages. So give us the setup and how that played out.
Sure. So in the CMO, we didn't put a range. We just said TBD. Which under, you know, Rule 26, that's fine. But then they propounded written discovery. And our answer in written discovery to how much are you going to ask for non-ec, it's going to be determined by a jury. I didn't put a range in there, which now I'm not sure if I learned was a mistake or not, honestly. But that was what our response was. And so they filed a motion in limine to preclude us from asking for any specific amount. And so we duked it out in motions practice. And ultimately, Judge Prince said, you can ask for non-ec, but you may not give them any formula, number, nothing. You can just say that non-ec exists. Now, most of my voir dire is based on damages. So I like to talk to the jury really early on about versus non-ec versus impairment and kind of get their feelings on, you know, as we're building that tribe, right? What can you do with this squishy concept of non-ec that you have to go in and decide, right? So I felt comfortable that we had a jury pool that was going to work together. Mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to ask for an amount. I couldn't give any sort of formula. I couldn't do anything. In fact, Judge Prince interrupted me in my closing without an objection from the other side. He interrupted me in my closing to say, as I was starting to talk about non-economic damages on the verdict form, he said, you're not going to do what I think you're going to do, are you? And I said, I'm not doing anything. I'm just telling them that there's a bucket here called non-ec. And then he told me to move on.
Well, I wanted to, before we talk about their actual award, in response, I just want to put out this. This is what we're doing right now, and I want to get your thought on it. When we are getting interrogatories asking for specific amounts of non-economics and impairment. What I did, and I just did this, I think, last week, so I haven't seen this play out, but we responded with the typical objection, the rule doesn't require it. And then I put in there, if counsel for defendant disagrees, we ask that you please raise this with the court now. Because I don't want to come in. I want to have that as, if you don't raise it, I don't want to have, and I think maybe I read your, I think that, actually I'm going to thank you because I read your trial report on the listserv and saw that and I was sort of concerned. I'm like, look, if they're asking that question, I don't want to just say objection. I want to say objection. And if you disagree, raise it with the court. So we'll see how that plays out. Now, I guess based on what happened to you before you heard that idea from me, are you now answering with a range when those questions are coming in or what are you all doing?
I'm giving a range, and my range typically is at least the underlying economics up to double the cap. That's kind of the range I live in. And I usually note that it's too early in discovery to determine a precise number. And we have a whole objection that we use firm-wide on that as well. The other thing too, and I think if you're going to do that range, I think then it's incumbent upon us as well to do motions in limine, basically stating defense can't stand up in their opening or voir dire and say they're going to ask you for $2 million in non-economic, because I think that's where it goes, right? Mm-hmm. They want then to show this absurdity right out of the gate. And I think we need to temper that. So if the court's on one hand going to make us give a range, they also kind of, I think, need to protect the outcome of how that range happens.
Wow, that's a really good way to handle that. So you sort of object saying the rule doesn't require it, number one. Number two, it's early in discovery. Number three, you know, this is for the jury. And then without waiving said objection, the range is between here and there. And then if defense counsel believes that we need to provide additional information, raise it with the court, and then eventually file a motion in limine, how have you seen that play out during depositions? Have you found defense attorneys aggressively trying to get testimony in depositions from your clients about both non-economics and impairment? And if so, what are you doing to prepare your clients for that?
Essentially, it's something that as an attorney or as attorneys, we need to have that conversation with our clients. That, I believe, enters into a privileged conversation in a deposition, particularly if we haven't had that discussion. And so my clients typically are saying, I need to talk to my lawyer about that. I don't know. That's kind of where it's been. I don't know if I've had any clients who've actually spit out a number.
Have you ever had to instruct your client not to answer, saying, you know, like sort of aggressively asserting attorney-client privilege on that?
I'm trying to think if I have or not. I did have one counsel. We ended up almost calling the court on it because I must have said not to answer, but I'm not recalling it off the top of my head. But yeah, I absolutely can see a scenario where that happened.
So, all right, Paul, back to you're not allowed to ask a number. But I thought I heard you say earlier that the jurors said you didn't ask for enough. So was that, help me understand sort of how that practically played out in terms of what you asked for and what the jury awarded?
So I wasn't allowed to ask for non-ec. For economics, we asked for the meds, which was a little over $186,000. And then I asked for an extra $100,000 on top of that for future care because I had a slide in my closing. Allison Gray had given us monetary values for her future care recommendations. Haley Burke did not. So we had a slide where we had Dr. Burke's recommendations with, you know, no dollar figures, and then Allison Gray's with dollar figures. And I figured $10,000 a year for 10 years. So that's why I only asked for $100,000. I was being really careful because El Paso is a conservative jurisdiction. You don't want to walk in there and just start asking for all kinds of stuff. And then for permanent impairment, I asked for $650,000. I had thought about more the night before. In fact, I had always valued this case at about $3 million in my mind. We work a lot with Stephen Padway with Elite Trial. He's awesome. So I had been on the phone with him for about an hour. And he said, I think you should ask for $2.7 million in permanency. And so I had that in my closing. And then I don't know, 20 minutes before I said, I can't do it, put in $650,000. I have to be able to say a number that I can get behind. So that's what we put in. And the jury decided otherwise. They thought that it wasn't enough, is what they told me. They said that in my closing, I had talked about how it was my rebuttal. And I had talked about how this is his last chance at any sort of closure and any sort of chance of being, you know, having an award to him to take care of him for the rest of his life. This is his final chapter, because our friends on the other side, their closing had been, when is it enough? When is it enough? And I said, this is it. This is his only chance. This has to be enough. And I talked about how, you know, the mortality table says he has 10 years left of his life and that's it. And so they went back, and one of the jurors told me that it really made her, what I had said, think about her own mortality and her family's and what it would look like to have to fund medical care in this economy and with these soaring medical rates. And so they all kind of thought about themselves a little bit. And then they said, what you asked for wasn't enough. And then they came up with these numbers. Yeah. And you know, sorry, Delamotte says that you want your juries to come back and say, can we give them more? And that has been a goal of mine for 2 years. And so it was really exciting to have this jury say, you didn't ask for enough. We needed to give him more.
And I do have to shout out, because when Jason Melichar did the closing, and he did, he sort of was like, and this, and you know, when is it enough, ladies and gentlemen? When is it enough? And again, because she's brilliant and experienced, but she walked right into that, and just, it was a brilliant rebuttal. Absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, it was. No, babe, like when you, because again, she just, I don't know if that's what she was planning, but when she got up, it was just raw and it was beautiful.
I never know what I'm going to say until I get up there sometimes.
I'm just so impressed that you have accomplished all these like bucket list items for me that I'm not sure will ever occur, including, can we award more than was asked for? And can we have a calculator? Like, none of those have ever happened. maybe someday. Last question before we wrap this up. Because I'm a little bit confused. You weren't allowed to ask for non-economics, but you're allowed to ask for impairment. What was the reasoning behind that difference?
It was the interrogatory.
Yeah, it was the interrogatory. Asked. They only asked for the non-ec piece. And the motion in limine also was only about non-economics, because they didn't take this seriously. They didn't even think that they had to talk about permanent impairment, right? Because they thought, never in a million years are they going to tie this permanent stroke, this permanent thoracic fracture to the crash. So we're not even going to worry about it.
Well, I tell you one thing that I have learned after doing a bunch of these podcast episodes, which I love because I learned so much, is that so many of these great results are as a result of mistakes made by the defense. And for whatever reason, we live in this world where all we do is catastrophize our own cases, our own abilities, and we're always thinking about what can go wrong. And we don't spend enough time thinking about, well, you know what? What can go wrong with the other side? When they come walking in and their doctor comes up and says, what? I'm here to talk about the shoulder. What are you talking about? Compression fracture. And you're like, okay. And to be present enough. Paula, there's two of those in trial gifts that were given to you that I'm hearing you handle just masterfully. This shoulder issue, no talking about the compression fracture, and then this, when is enough enough? So that you are present, probably as a result of your experience or just your brilliance, to listen and respond is just amazing. Kudos to you and Sandra. What an amazing result. So thank you so much. And with that, we'll wrap this up until the next episode. I am just so inspired, truly inspired by the amazing work that you and your firm is doing. So thank you both so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Keith.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, we loved it. Let's go get them. Let's get them some more.
Yeah.
Yeah, go get more and come back on and tell us what we can do and what we can learn. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Keith.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you've gained valuable insights and inspiration from today's courtroom warriors. And thank you for being in the arena. Make sure to subscribe and join us next time as we continue to dissect real cases and learn from Colorado's top trial lawyers. Our mission is to empower our legal community, helping us to become better trial lawyers to effectively represent our clients. Keep your connection to Colorado's best trial lawyers alive at www.thectlc.com.